This is the Nomad Futurist Podcast, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and transformation. Connect with us, share your thoughts with us at nomadfuturist.com. Let's get this started. Here are Phil and Nabil.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Nomad Futurist. This is your co-host, Nabil Mahmood from Kailua Kona, Hawaii.
This is your co-host, Philip Koblenz from Montclair, New Jersey. I need to come up with a more amazing way to say Montclair, New Jersey, because Kailua Kona, Hawaii just sounds so good.
You got to follow the Jersey Shores, Phil.
Right.
No doubt.
And here, Daniel Pope from Barcelona.
Yeah. Daniel, I was really expecting more of a Barcelona, but that's got a little bit more of an English flavor. Anyhow, welcome to Nomad Futurist Podcast. Lovely to have you. So before we get started, could you share at a very high level who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I'm the CTO today and founder of a company called Submer, which is headquartered in Barcelona. Submer develops immersion cooling technology, and we'll talk a little bit about what that is exactly, but it's basically changing the medium that we use to cool next generation compute platforms. And we do that by replacing the medium for liquid instead of air. So all compute today is cooled by air, as we probably know. And we change that for a non-conductive liquid. So you actually put all these electronics into a liquid, which is the opposite of what they taught us to do, right? And it works beautifully. It brings a lot of benefits, cooling high-density chips. And yeah, although I'm headquartered in Barcelona, we have a global operation. But that's what we're doing today. And our products and our technology are mostly focused on large-scale crypto mining operations and the data center industry, including anything from enterprise customers to hyperscale companies. So Google, Amazon, AWS, etc.
All those tiny companies. Well, for all those kids that are freaking out every time you drop your iPhone or your bed in water, apparently there might be an alternative.
Yeah, life's good in water. It really sounds like an Aquaman thing. Well, we're going to get back to it in just a bit. So let's step back in time. You have been with different organizations through your career. Tell us how you got exposed to the technology sector at early part in your life. Because from what I see, you have been with organizations that have been in and around data in some way, form, or shape. So Walk us through that early childhood. How did you get exposed to the sector and what helped you get into the space?
Yeah. So I've always been a tinkerer. I've always liked to take things apart. And I think when I was 11 or 12, my parents bought me my first PC. And the first thing that I did was take it apart and break it. I basically broke it. It cost them a fortune. And I took it apart, put it together, and it didn't work. And so in that journey, once we fixed it again, I took it apart and I put it together again, right? And that time it did work. And I guess I managed to understand how PCs work, how computers work, at a very young age and understand them much better. And then from there, I started using the internet, the early internet, I guess, when things were like they are today. They were based on things called BBSs and you had dial-up type of connectivity and so on. But obviously, like today, the internet back then was already a big source of information. So that was kind of the very early days.
Did your parents get angry when you took apart the computer?
They did. Yeah, unfortunately, they very told off about that. Right?
So not necessarily that we want to age you here, but could you tell us what was the model or the make of that computer?
That was 8086. I think it was running Windows, just about managed to run Windows 3.1 on that.
It's sort of like in the mid-90s then, or mid to early.
Yeah, 90s. Yeah. That was 93, 92, 93, probably something like that. Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up between the UK and Barcelona. So my mother's from Barcelona. My father's from London. At the age of 9, I was living in the UK. My mother said to my father, look, the weather and the food is just crap in the UK. We're going back to Spain.
You mean don't like your fish and chips then?
I do. I miss them every now and then, but I prefer my Spanish jamón, my Spanish ham and my paella and so on. So yeah.
It's a tough comparison. I don't know much about Europe, but even with my limited knowledge, I don't think it's difficult to suggest that the Barcelonan cuisine outpaces the English.
It's much better.
Mediterranean cuisine is way better, absolutely. So then maybe following on that, like at the age of 14, I was already teaching elderly groups of people to use the internet, basically. So I was working for social center that was basically trying to teach elderly people how to use, send emails, use the web back And I think they were quite surprised that they had a 14-year-old teaching them. And the reason why is because I could actually get access into these cyber cafes that they used to provide this training and get some hours on the internet for free, right? And learn more things. That's kind of how things started and how I got very exposed to the internet.
So much of the people that are leaders in our industry, it just happens that you were there. You were a tinkerer at the right place at the right time. So you kind of learned it while everyone else was kind of learning it. So it's this unique kind of pioneer element to it that is sheer happenstance. Were your parents in the technology space as jobs?
Nowhere near. No. My mother a secretary, my father a taxi driver. So like nothing to do with it, interestingly. Yeah.
And just out of curiosity, so what made them get a computing device for you at that young of an age?
I was insisting that I really wanted one of these things. Like I was already reading magazines back then, like PC World and so on. I'm like, I need one of these things. I don't really know what it does, but I need one of these things. I'm sure it's going to be important. And so I managed to convince them and they used the very little saving that they had to buy me one. I don't think they regret it today, but...
Well, of course, the results in the pudding or the paella. All right. So you're in school, you put the PC back together, you're potentially programming and teaching in the elderly. Did you go to college to pursue technology as a career or like everybody else? You picked up mathematics or other subjects?
No, I didn't. I really wanted to, honestly. At the age of 16, I started my first data center business. And back then it was just the web hosting business. So over a weekend, I kind of put together a server, put it in one of the drawers in my bedroom, configured it, put Linux in it and so on, and developed a website over the weekend and started selling web hosting and email services, making out that I would just fake it till you make it, right? I would just say, look, I'm a company based in Spain, providing internet services. And I called this .com boom. And it just went wild. I just had like tens, then hundreds of customers per month. And so I had to combine my studies with the fact that I was also in semi-professional sport as a rower. And at one moment in time, I had to decide if I wanted to focus on my sport, my rowing, the business, or go to university, right? And I chose the business. And I learned how to program. Pretty much everything I've done is self-taught, honestly, until now.
So I'm assuming it's late 90s, early 2000s that you kickstarted this company. Was it the Data House Internet?
Yep, that's right.
It was literally in his house.
Exactly.
So Data House Internet is what that company turned into. So I started this business in 98, and then it grew to the point where I'm like, this is a big problem now. I need to build a serious data center. And I went through multiple iterations. But yeah, we built four or five iterations of data centers during the Data House Internet period. Yep. In a decade, over a decade. And we went from one server in my bedroom to 18,000 servers in a big data center.
That's an amazing thing. I think you hear a lot of people that start young, and I think you have me beat. I started at 17. So congratulations on that.
Well, Joel did the same thing as well.
I did not do the same thing at all. You did it a much, much better way than I did. I used my bar mitzvah money to buy a server. But I think people make the assumption that you have professional parents that are lawyers and they're helping you figure out how to run a business. How did you manage to, as a 16-year-old, kind of figure out how to run a business and prioritize? And those are not the problems that a 16-year-old of today would think of, or even of that era. It's an amazing thing.
That's a really good question. I actually went out and looked for someone to help me. I tried to find a good partner, a good business partner that could cover the day-to-day business side of things. And my role was to focus on the technology. And I'm pretty much in that situation right now as well, right? I've just moved again from CEO to CTO of the company where I am now, because that's where I thrive and what I enjoy doing.
How'd you find that partner? So did you put an ad in the paper? Did you just walk around the street saying, help me, help me?
I went to the city hall here in Barcelona where they had a counseling service for companies that was starting, and I just went there and said, look, guys, I don't know how to do my accounting. There's a lot of things that I don't know how to, I don't really want to do them. Is there some kind of services that you provide to startups that can help me solve this? And the guy I pitched my story to became my partner at the city hall. It just he went, oh shit, this is so interesting. Tell me more about it.
You're generating monthly recurring revenue. I want that.
I want the mailbox money. That's what he's thinking.
What was your parents' reaction to you starting a business? Were they supportive of it? Were they like, you're wasting your time? You should focus on rowing. You should go to university?
Yeah, at the beginning, they were kind of reluctant. Of course, I'd say they weren't completely supporting me, but very quickly, when I started to show them that this crazy idea actually had a serious monthly income and it was becoming a big thing and that I was learning a lot of things, they'd become very supportive, very supportive. And the fact, when I told them, no, I'm not going to continue with my studies now because there's this and I still want to keep on rowing and so on, they went, we understand, don't worry, it's fine. So they became very supportive.
So tell us about your family dynamics. Were you the only child or you had other siblings?
I have a smaller sister, a couple of years younger than me. She's nowhere near in or around IT. So yeah, I think that's the proof of why where we don't come from an IT background or family that pushed us in that direction in any way. It's just that I was very intrigued by what was all this internet technology about and computer technology, and that took me to servers, which then took me to software automation and orchestration that we'll get to. That was kind of the next step in my journey, and now to data center infrastructure. And yeah,
wonderful. Now fast forward, family, kids, anybody in this space, anybody looking to get in this space?
So I've got two kids, a 9-year-old boy and a 6-year-old girl. That I love them. They're crazy. This is an interesting one, talking about technology. I think I've never heard about it before. So this weekend, my eldest kid managed to extract a tooth from my young kid with an iPad. I've never seen that before. He whacked her in the face and the tooth went.
Those are the multiple uses of technology that people don't necessarily think about, is the blunt force trauma.
Yeah, I'm just curious, what kind of angular whack was that?
Is that covered by insurance?
Luckily, it was a tooth that was moving and it was going to fall sooner or later. And I think I've never heard a story with a tooth being removed with an iPad. Yeah, and I'm married to my marvelous wife, who is a friend from my teens. So lifelong wife, I guess. 20 years together now, so...
And is she into tech
she's in the tech industry. So she's actually owned her own businesses in the past, software development. And now she's in one of the big US tech companies where I used to be working. She's still there.
All right. I guess we'll find out. Is that Ingram Micro?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what we do. All right. So now you had an exit in 2010 from Data House. Tell us through that acquisition by Telefonica. How did that come about? And for somebody that's not been in the space, and of course, sounds like that you got the right mentorship and the right partnership to drive that, but it was your baby. What made you say, okay, I'm done. I'm moving forward. This is enough.
So business was thriving. Things were going really well. But if you look back in 2009, 2010 is when the big cloud providers started to come into the space. So like Microsoft, Azure, Amazon Web Services, Google Cloud, these things didn't exist before that, right? And so I was going to become a competitor or try to compete with these big monsters, right? And I realized back then that that made no sense. But companies like Telefonica definitely thought that they could compete with these guys. And so they went out and started to acquire a number of data center companies across Europe to kind of build a more solid position for when this competition was going to occur. And so I had this really efficient data center operation run by very few people with a lot of automation. We managed to really build a slick, streamlined business operation. And it was just the right moment. I'm like, look, this is going to become a nightmare when these players come in. They're going to be very aggressive. I've already gone through a lot because obviously a 10-year journey going from a server in your bedroom to an 18,000 server data center, there are ups and downs there in the whole journey. And I thought this is probably the right time to get off the bus. And we had a very successful exit with Telefonica. And I spent, I think it was a year, supporting the transition from my infrastructure to Telefonica's infrastructure. And then I'm like, okay, what shall I do now? And I thought I'd taken a little bit, I'd try and work for someone else now for some time. Right, let's see what happens. And one of my customers reached out to me and said, Danny, we developed software for the industry where you were working. We think you'd be really valuable. Come and work for us. And I joined a company called Parallels, which might ring a bell because they also have a software called Desktop that allows you to run, I think it's Windows on your Mac. But they also had a whole different division, a kind of secret division, that was developing orchestration software for telecommunication companies and for data center companies, cloud orchestration. Very complex stuff for billing subscription and billing for software usage. And like when you now purchase a landline, well, you don't purchase landlines anymore, but a mobile cell phone number, you now get your Netflix subscription and your connectivity at home and all that kind of gets provisioned and billed by these orchestration platforms. And I kind of had a similar platform that I developed for orchestrating my data center provisioning and server provisioning and so on. So I obviously also have a background in the software side of things. And so I spent a number of years at Parallels. Parallels got acquired by a company called Odin. Then they got acquired by a company called Ingram Micro, which is a big US technology distributor. And Ingram Micro basically figured out that they weren't going to be selling software in boxes for a long time, which one of their core businesses was just to sell and move boxes. So subscriptions and software subscriptions were the thing. And that's why they acquired this orchestration software. And I spent a number of years as solution architect for this orchestration platform. And then I ran the professional services teams at Ingram Micro across EMEA and kind of saw it from the other side. I was still working with telcos and data centers and deploying this orchestration software for them. And then after a number of years, I was wondering, well, maybe now is the right time. I was still very connected to the data center industry. Maybe now is the right time to implement a technology that I saw back in 2009 and considered it was a little bit too early for that back then, but immersion cooling. Maybe very high level, immersion cooling, as I mentioned, is really just about using a different medium to cool chips. And you only want to use a different medium when you can't cool with air, because air is very cheap, very efficient, quite efficient. And but like in many other industries, and we can talk about, for example, the automotive industry. When an engine becomes too powerful, you can't cool it with air anymore. You have to liquid cool it, right? Well, the same's happening in the data center industry now. Chips were, when you bought a server, your server came with a chip that was maybe a 50, 80 watt chip. And now today, when you buy a server, your server comes with 600, 700 watt chips, and you can't cool them with air anymore. So liquid cooling is becoming a thing in the data center industry. And there are many different types of liquid cooling technologies, but one that is definitely set up to dominate the market is immersion cooling. And Submer, the company that I founded and the CTO of back in 2015, definitely is set to be a leader in the space.
Well, I mean, that's pretty great. Early. So, yeah. It's amazingly early, right? For a submersion cooling company or an immersion cooling company rather to come out in 2015. I mean, you hear about it a lot now in data center circles with the advent of AI and obviously Bitcoin mining and all these 100 kilowatt plus racks, 300 kilowatt racks, I think CyrusOne claimed that they were able to facilitate in some of their sites. What was the driver? Like, was there a particular thing that you saw other than you understanding the direction that chips were moving? Was there one particular problem that you saw that you said this submersion cooling is the answer for? Because it does seem to be a departure from your initial kind of technology software-based focus to really more infrastructure focus. So I wonder how that transition happened.
Yeah, so I'd say the main driver was the chip density. So having seen what was happening in the inside of the servers, and obviously I was very familiar with server technology, I could see how the thermal design power of the chip, so basically how many watts a chip has, was growing exponentially. And 2 years ago, we had 200 watt chips. Today, we have 400 watt chips. Tomorrow, we're going to have, again, 600, 800, and 1,000 watt chips. So it's growing exponentially because it took us nearly 40 years to go from the first 8086 chip, the 2-watt chip, to the 200 watt chip. But then it's only taken us 2 years to go from the 200 watt chip to the 400 watt chip. So that's the challenge that the data center industry is facing. And we could already see that, like in 2015. We could already see that. And what does that mean? That means that it's impossible to sustain the traditional air cooling technologies in that environment, one. The other one was the big sustainability push in the industry. So you could start to see things like people uncovering the amount of water that was being used in the data center industry, which has been this deep, dark little secret of the industry for a long time. No one knows about it, but your medium data center is evaporating 2 Olympic swimming pools of water every day, basically. It's ridiculous. And so every time you're uploading a photo, think about that. And so this was uncovered a number of years back, and now it's like very public that it's a big issue for the industry, and water's becoming the other trend, obviously, is climate change, and being based in Europe and understanding the challenges very well that that will mean for the planet. We said, look, there's less water. Data centers today are consuming lots of water. There's this challenge with the chips. This is a technology that can fix those three things in one go. So that's why we thought that in 2015, it was the right timing. Honestly, it was a little bit early. It's taken us a few years for it to really become, accelerate the adoption. And the reason for that, we believe, is that the data center industry is a very entrenched industry with a lot of ecosystem partners that have their very entrenched interests as well. And so it's taken a little bit more time to break that than what we would have anticipated, but being patient is part of the key, right? Finding that right moment. We've been able to, I'd say, bridge the gap with the crypto mining industry. The crypto miners have no doubt that immersion is the most efficient way to run their operations. We've deployed hundreds of megawatts of immersion technology in the crypto mining space across the globe, but mostly in the hottest and harshest environments where electricity is cheap, because that's where these guys deploy usually their infrastructure. And so we've been able to bridge that gap between crossing of the desert, as we've called it, where it's taken time for the data center industry to pick up, basically.
So how did you come about 50 years later? It's nothing new, really, not to blow the bubble, right? So in 1966, IBM actually came up with immersion cooling. 1968, they patented. 50 years later, you decide that you're going to launch this project, or product for that matter, knowing might as well that at that point in time, roughly three decades of computing, we've been cooling, building a certain way. And what you're trying to accomplish totally changes the entire sector. I mean, we're not going to be manufacturing servers and storage equipment the way we did in the past because of high density computing, because we're going to submerge all of it. So that's a major, major risk, both personally, professionally, and trying to bring a product back into existence that did not succeed the first time when the three-letter word tried to do it. How did you go about raising money, selling that concept to the private equity folks, selling that concept into the marketplace? Could you share that at a high level?
Yeah, and I think honestly, like back in the day when Cray had this first supercomputer, as you mentioned, with immersion cooling, there really was a need for it. It was like a fancy thing to design a supercomputer with that requirement. But the power of the chip on that supercomputer was much less than what's in your normal smartphone today, like hundreds of times less. So, and this is completely cooled passively. So it was just a fancy thing. Now it's actually become a need, and it's becoming a need because of the reasons that I described. So the way we managed to raise money, being a European company, was really emphasizing on the ESG aspect of this technology, right? So how this makes sense from a sustainability perspective, if compute is going to explode as everyone anticipates now, and we have to deploy five times the amount of compute that we have today in the next 5 years, then does it make sense to build that compute infrastructure with the inefficient technologies and ways that we've been doing it until now, right? Do we really think that we can evaporate five times the water that we're evaporating today, consume five times the power, etc.? And so for us, it's been relatively easy to raise money. It is true that all our investors are impact funds, meaning they all invest in technologies that can change the world for a better thing. And so we've been very fortunate to position the business and the technology as an impact business. And there's a big mandate, obviously, from Europe to drive these type of companies and technologies to meet the Paris agreements and things like that. And so for us, it's kind of been a walk in the park to raise money.
One of the things we talk about in terms of ESG and our industry in particular is that while other industries use it as a checkbox, our industry is acutely impacted by needing to become more efficient as a consequence of power costs and just the ability to kind of deal with the densities that you're looking at with some of these modern technologies. So I think leveraging sustainability as a means to raise money from those impact funds makes a ton of sense, but it's also, we're in an industry that acutely benefits from it financially also. So we kind of align with those ESG metrics. So my question really is on the pushback. Was there any pushback? I think in general, the pushback that I would think of, just if I was looking at it, is, all right, besides as a kid taught not to like drop electronics in water because water is bad. And well, we can get into what makes up this viscous fluid, and it's not really water. It's like some other makeup. But you have this thing submerged. We think of a data center as you go in there, you have to maintain it. You got to go in there and change out hard drives and deal with the gear. That seems to like it would be complicated if it was submerged. Was there any pushback on that? Is there any truth to that logistically?
So the operations in immersion are kind of one of the first pushbacks that people anticipate and think about. But when you look at the challenges with other liquid cooling technologies, this is not about comparing with air, because you can't use air anymore, right? So you have to compare with other liquid cooling technologies. And if you compare it to other liquid technologies, you have humongous challenges and setbacks. So the fact that you want to run water through the chips, which is obviously one of the how competing technologies, direct to the chip or direct liquid cooling, that is a big problem if you have a leak, right? If you have a leak, you do lose hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in hardware equipment that is...
Well, it's also the soft costs as well. You've got your entire infrastructure down, what's making you money. So yeah, it could be billions of dollars for some.
And so there are many technical challenges with the competing liquid technologies, anything from just reliability and uptime of the systems to corrosion of the water and the liquids that go through these boards to, you still need a lot of air cooling in a direct-to-chip system because you're only taking the heat away from the CPUs and the GPUs, which, yes, is the majority of the heat, but it's not all the heat. There's still a lot of heat produced in a server that comes from other components. And so it still means you need lots of air cooling, which is, again, back to that inefficiency of the data center, water consumption, et cetera, and so on. So it's kind of halfway there. We see it as the plug-in hybrid in the automotive industry, while as immersion, we compare it to the full EV. And yeah, that's probably the easy way to put it, I guess.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a question, and I want the honest truth. So Michael Dell made a statement that he does not want to immerse his servers because they're going to be slimy. Very technical statement from Michael Dell. How do you rebuttal that? How do you answer that?
I think he's not going to have another option in the very short term, honestly. Where the chip densities are going and the push for the Paris agreements and other ESG drivers, I think everyone's going to be forced, because the customers at the end of the day are going to look at TCO. If it's all about TCO in this industry and in any industry. But if the crypto miners have gone down this path, which is probably one of the most TCO aggressive or ROI aggressive industries that exist out there, I can assure you the data center industry is going to end up down the same path. The challenge is we've got this very complex, entrenched ecosystem. It's going to take time to digest a lot of this and look at it holistically, because we've kind of built silos in the data center industry where you had your IT guys and you had your infrastructure guys. And we've always really kept those things separate. Now what happens is that your infrastructure, your cooling infrastructure goes into your IT. It kind of all comes together and it creates this very uncomfortable situation for the data center industry. And they're kind of digesting that still and figuring out how they're going to live with that. But I'd love to tell Michael Dell in person that he's going to end up submerging his...
That's the takeaway from this thing. The press release is Daniel Pope to Michael Dell, embrace the slime.
Exactly. So just from a thought leadership perspective, quantum is right around the corner. I mean, not that it's mass marketed yet, but I believe within the next decade, as we look at all these cycles that we're going through, it's going to be mass marketed. It's going to be streamlined. And now we're cooling at 459 degrees Kelvin. How do you go about addressing that as it entails to with what you're doing? And is this the third potential startup for Daniel Pope, or that point in time liquid cooling is gone?
It's a great question. So obviously quantum is great for very specific workloads, and it'll never be a technology for general compute. And I guess workloads as we consume them today and in the mass market, definitely not in the next decade. But we do believe that, and we're doing a lot of R&D in superfluids and other, I'd say, more aggressive immersion implementations that could surely be a solution for quantum down the road. Yeah. So Summer is focusing on what is, I guess, the core of the compute that's being deployed today with our product. But I'm pretty sure that if quantum becomes a thing, we'll also figure out how to submerge quantum computers.
Love it. 459 degrees Kelvin, right? I mean, that's going to be bloody cold. All right. So you've got a very interesting journey, sort of like history repeats itself. It's sort of like what I've kind of captured, what's been done in the past. Don't just throw it away. You can potentially leverage that. It might be the next big idea, like you've totally demonstrated from. Exactly. Good timing. What would be your message to the younger Daniel Poe, to your kids and other people that are not really exposed to the data infrastructure sector? How do we get them into the space? What do we need to do? What's your message?
I would say that everything that we do today is in one way or another connected to a data center. There are very few actions that we take in our day-to-day life. Anything from obviously looking at our phone, working with our laptop, taking a car from A to B, et cetera, that doesn't have a transaction running through a data center, right? And that's just with AI and other innovative technologies that are going to change our lives in the near future, like robotics. Data centers are the hearts of our civilization, honestly. We rely on them as one of the most critical pieces of infrastructure and probably one of the most unknown, because if you ask anyone in the street, what is a data center? A lot of people can't really answer that question. So I would definitely welcome the younger generations to look at a bigger picture and how all these connected devices and connected lives are going to just become even more connected, to investigate how these things work, what they are, just as I did back in the 90s, I guess.
And that's really the thing. And as we bring it to a close, what an inspiring story you have. It's incredible. But I think a lot of the common thinking is that you need to be particularly computer focused or engineering focused, or you need to be in a specific mindset in order to get into our space. And what we have preached this entire time is that it just takes kind of recognizing 30,000 foot view, your perspective on how you solve problems and how you look at things. And there is certainly a place for you in our industry, whether you are computer focused or engineering focused or finance focused or marketing focused or whatever, it doesn't really make a difference. Do you have one trait that you think, or a couple traits that you think you can speak to, that really kind of ensured your success, the way you look at things, and whether there's truth to the fact that you actually don't need to be an engineer that has gone through an engineering program in order to succeed in our world?
Yeah, I would say, I think like anyone who also has an interest in ESG in general, just sustainability, right? And I think all the younger generations are way more intrigued by how we do things in a more gentle way with our planet. I think that's definitely a trait that I've always personally felt identified with, which is very far away from anything related to IT. When I walk in a forest and take a stroll in a forest, it makes me think about what I'm doing in the data center industry, right? And I'd say that even someone who wants to make a change from an impact perspective, the data center industry is also a place where there's a lot to be done. And all major operators today have big ESG teams, right? Trying to figure out how to really create an impact.
Very good.
And who better than the people that are going to be impacted by that world to make that change, right?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. It's been absolutely phenomenal. Look forward to seeing you in person one of these days.
Absolutely. And if it's in Hawaii, even more.
I was going to say, if it was in Barcelona, even more.
You're always welcome when you're in Barcelona. Feel free to reach out.
Lovely. This has been great. Nothing lasts forever. Markets will come back. Currencies will rebound. Businesses will go on. And we will all move on. That could happen next week, next month, or next year. At Nomad Futurists, we're confident that those who prepare rather than panic will come out of this stronger. Thank you for joining us. This has been brought to you by Nomad Futurist. Check us online at nomadfuturist.org. And thank you for listening and subscribing, as well as your continued support.